Blog Talk Radio. Despite Enki's plasma drives, the Nibiru planetoid had picked up momentum when it swung around the sun, and calculations showed that while the plasma drives could slow and steer it, without a working planetary drive, the planetoid would be flung back out of the solar system. But even with a new supply of materials and manufactured goods being shuttled to Nibiru from Ki, Earth, repairs on the planetary drive were painfully slow. And with each passing day, Nibiru's energy demands increased, and the time it took to shuttle materials increased as the planetoid retreated into deep space. Enlil's survey of Kiru, Mars, had painted a bleak picture of the damage inflicted on it by the hail of planetary debris that had struck it. The atmosphere had been blasted away, as had much of the planet's formerly abundant water. Most of the infrastructure the Igigi had left was destroyed, with the exception of some mines. It would take longer to rebuild Kiru to a habitable level than they had before Nibiru would become uninhabitable if they did not get the planetary drive working. So the decision was made to evacuate all but a small team to Ki, and to split the population proportionally between the established outposts. An recalled his brother, Nedimud, from Eridu, supposedly to command the technicians who were repairing the planetary drive, but the real reason for the recall was the Tablets of Destiny. Even before the Anunnaki left their homeworlds, the tablets had been behaving erratically. The tablets were the crowning achievement of Anunnaki computer science, a causality engine that computed likely future outcomes of any decision or action with great accuracy. It was the tablets that had forecast the cosmic disaster that had destroyed their homeworlds, and had given metaphorical clues that allowed the Igi'im, the astronomers, to locate and verify the threat. That prediction marked the turning point in the usefulness of the Tablets of Destiny. Each response it gave after that catastrophic foretelling was more metaphysical and symbolic than the one before it. Because of the difficulty of interpreting the responses, An had almost ceased to consult the tablets for most decisions, relying instead on his own experience, a circumstance he had chosen to hide from the rest of the Anunnaki. This subterfuge, at first, was easy. As leader of the Anunnaki, the tablets were in fact his oracle, and he could do with them as he pleased. During the long journey, however, logical cases had been made to recreate the computational network the Anunnaki had used on their homeworld, which had included the Tablets of Destiny as its centerpiece, after they were again established on the new worlds. When the planetary drive was sabotaged, this act gave An a reason to keep the tablets safeguarded, but he knew, when he brought the tablets to Ki, that the argument again would be raised to restore them to public use. In his youth, Nedimud had worked as a senior technician on the project that created the tablets, so An was hoping that his older brother, whose confidentiality he trusted, could restore the tablet's functionality before they were moved to Ki and tied into its distributed computing grid. Enki found himself shuttling back and forth between the mining operations in what are now called South Africa and Pakistan, the manufacturing facilities in India and China, and the lifting stations across the Middle East in Turkey, Russia, South Africa, Pakistan, Burma, southwestern China, and Cambodia, struggling to keep them coordinated while he trained the very young men and women who had been prematurely put in charge of them. The idea of moving youngsters had seemed ideal, since the optimism of youth would help insulate them from the trauma of losing everything they had known. But they hadn't counted on the harsher conditions on Earth, the growth of god cults among the humans, the loss of Kivu as a primary base, or the sabotage of the planetary drive that could lead to the loss of Nibiru. The time required to cope with the series of disasters had come directly out of the time that should have been spent training the young achievers and maturing them into proper leaders, and this deficit of guidance was definitely beginning to show. On the way back to Kurgal, what we call South Africa, Enki flew over the edge of what had once been Lemuria and detected a faint electromagnetic signature. A small power plant was operating underwater. He plunged his craft toward the signature and discovered a small remaining outpost of Wanus. Only about a dozen of their former allies remained, and the story they had to tell was grim. After the Anunnaki had been recalled, the Wanus had performed an orderly evacuation, only to be viciously attacked as they neared their home system. These survivors, who included a high-level priest of the Wanus and his daughter, did not know who the attackers were, and also were unsure of what happened to the remainder of their people, half of whom they thought had been killed, and the other half captured, leaving only one ship to escape and return to Ki, where they decided to hide until the Anunnaki returned. The Wanus were likewise horrified to hear what had happened to the Anunnaki, but Enki promised that their people would again work together to become strong and numerous. Enki was also overjoyed to discover a friend from his boyhood among the surviving Wanus, Izimud, whose actual name is pronounceable only to Wanus and cetaceans, and asked him to step into the role of Chancellor of Eridu, which had been vacant since Nudimmud returned to Nibiru. Izimud agreed and left with Enki, with promises of renewed solidarity between Wanus and Anunnaki. On Nibiru, Nudimmud confronted the problem of the Tablets of Destiny as any scientist might, by running a diagnostic, which the tablets aborted halfway through and, instead of returning the appropriate error codes, displayed a navigational map of their former residence with lines leading away from it, including a line representing Nibiru's trajectory. Many higher-ranking Anunnaki possessed personal spacecraft capable of interstellar travel, so failure to be selected for Nibiru was not an automatic death sentence for all Anunnaki. Most of these flight paths traced toward the Pleiades, and each was intercepted by a line in a different color, and then these new flight paths continued on to the Anunnaki homeworlds, where they were quickly joined by many other incoming trajectories. The tablets then launched into a multimedia display of snippets of badly distorted communication, images, and data streams cut off in mid-transmission. Nudimmud immediately set Nibiru's monopole transmitter to sweep an arc of space with a simple ping that would be recognized by any Anunnaki electronic data system as an invitation to connect, while the tablets cryptically repeated the phrase Girikur, unfamiliar path, and a long string of gibberish sprinkled with a few familiar words like Akur, fortification or prison, and an assortment of references to reptiles and amphibians, which An speculated aloud might refer to the missing Wanus, but Nudimmud silently wondered if the snake people had returned, and if so, how his brother would handle it. Every time he visited one of the sites, Enki's concerns grew. Kurgal should have been able to supply all of the materials needed to repair the planetary drive, but the youngsters had formed cliques, or guilds, and were competing as much as cooperating. It didn't help that Enlil had been down there organizing athletic competitions among them for his amusement. The lifting stations were suffering a similar effect. Time and materials were being wasted on recreation, and again his half-brother had a hand in it, as he had taken a liking to aerial hunting. The farther away outposts in India and China were faring much better. Not only were they removed from the immediacy of Enlil's influence, the humans there naturally had evolved calmer dispositions, and it had been easy to enhance their intelligence for the technical work they were employed to do. but the success of these outposts were dependent upon the supply chain and the mines. Enki wasn't entirely unsympathetic to the youngsters. He had definitely sowed his own wild oats when he had been on Earth previously with his uncle and the other Igigi, but that had been at a time when the mission could afford the luxury of some youthful indiscretions. The hard reality of their current situation wasn't going to afford these youngsters a similar opportunity. The situation at Kurgal degenerated after the youngsters brought in a group of humans to perform manual labor, but failed to see that these humans brought with them a warlord mentality. This mentality, combined with the previously seeded competitiveness in the young Anunnaki minds, resulted in open mutiny and violent conflict between the labor guilds and the administrative and scientific guilds. Enki took his personal Erengard down there to restore order and to reorganize the mining operation. And while he was gone, Enlil secretly seduced Enki's wife, Damkina. Enki returned to Eridu, stressed and distracted, and did not notice the change in his relationship with his wife, since they had a long history of taking breaks from one another. So he took the fact that she had relocated her life laboratory and herself to a nearby settlement to be a practical matter, as the growth of human settlements around Eridu had encroached on her previous facility. As secrets always do, news got out about the possibility that some other civilization may have come to the rescue of the Anunnaki left behind. The emotional distraction of the tablet's oddly cryptic message wasn't helping the Anunnaki mission on Earth either, which was struggling with the logistics of simultaneously setting up facilities, adapting their physiology to Earth conditions, training humans, finding and acquiring materials to repair the planetary drive, and looking for ways to rescue Nibiru before it escaped the solar system. While Nibiru's plasma drive sculpted all of the asteroid ice the Magan boats could bring to slow its exit from the heliosphere, attention turned to speculation about what happened after they left their homeworld and provided an irresistible focus for any Anunnaki with even the slightest amount of telepathic ability, as each spent hours reaching out in hope of finding friends, relatives, and neighbors given up for dead. To recapture focus and restore discipline, Enki sat down with Anzu the next time he took shore leave from managing the Magan transport and overseeing the Kiru salvage operation. Together, they devised a plan to formalize the management of the lifting stations into a military structure in the hope that discipline and structure would help channel youthful enthusiasm into productive work and minimize Enlil's corrupting influence. Anzu then went from base to base, organizing and recruiting, building tactical wings, and using military instruction to impart at least some ethics and a sense of responsibility. This attempt to limit his growing influence on the youthful Anunnaki angered Enlil greatly, so he closed the spaceports under his direction, Nippur, Giza, Turkey, and Pakistan, to all but his own ships, and started building his own wings out of the heavy lifting bases in Turkey and Pakistan. It was during this time that Enki first began to feel ill. At this critical time, showing weakness was not an option for the commander of Earth, so Enki invented an excuse to absent himself from Eridu to visit his friend Shimugan in the area known now as Turkey. Away from Eridu, Enki quickly regained his strength and met and fell in love with Shimugan's daughter, also a genetic engineer, whose primary focus at the time was improving the amount and quality of wool produced by the local sheep. As the time for his visit drew to a close, Enki asked the girl, whose name was Ma'a, to become his second wife. Despite her father's urging, she refused, stating that she would be second to no woman, and further, that she had no use for Eridu or its politics. Eridu. Welcome, everybody, to another audio blog. I've got quite a number of people that have been listening to these shows, and I want to thank everyone, whether you're listening live or in the archives. I do ask that the people that are listening in the archives, if you're enjoying my show, leave me a comment on my Blog Talk Radio channel. Let me know that you've been by and that you're liking or would like to see some different information. Just give me some feedback because, you know, I like having you listen, but I also like to hear from you, too. It's good to have a dialogue as well. So please just leave me a note. Today's show basically was just another installation of the Anunnaki history. This time we're getting a little bit more personal, because we're starting to see some things going on in Enki's life that were less than ideal. It really almost, if my reaction when I started learning this stuff was, your life was a soap opera, wasn't it? And it pretty much was a soap opera in a way. But the whole thing was just so, histories have a way of grouping events in knots so that crazy stuff that's going on in societies and crazy stuff that's going on in people's lives tend to group. It's like what they always say when they say it comes in threes. Well, it comes in at least threes. So the Anunnaki were going through one of those really tough periods, and no one was particularly exempt from that. One of the takeaways that that we can learn from the goings on in the mines at Kurgal was that you don't do business with terrorists. You don't do business with the mafia. You don't do business with the bad guys. If you do business with the bad guys, guess what's going to happen? You're either going to become a bad guy or you're going to have problems from the bad guys. And they had a bit of both going on. We have the same stuff going on in the world today. This is another one of the lessons we failed to learn or learn properly from the Anunnaki. And that is, don't do business with bad guys. Look around. Take a look at all the black ops stuff that's going on. Who is that? Who are our multinational corporations doing business with? Who are our doing business with? And then we wonder why stuff keeps going weird. Well, it keeps going weird because we're doing business with bad guys. When you look at what's going on over in Afghanistan, for example, or in Iraq, all of that came about because we went over there and started stirring up trouble for whatever economic reasons were behind it. We started stirring trouble over there, and we started getting in bed with the bad guys, because the bad guys would sell out, and they would give up, you know, whatever they thought we wanted to hear. Well, what happens when you deal with somebody who is dealing in information and influence for money? Are you going to get loyalty? Are you going to get good work? Or are you going to get something that's going to get that person a paycheck? Who cares whether or not the information they give you is correct? Who cares if they're selling you out behind your back? They don't care. They just want their paycheck. Same thing with prisons. They recently started looking at a lot of these convictions that have been based on what they call a jailhouse informant. It's where somebody who's already in jail for having done something or suspected for having done something comes forward and says, oh, by the way, while I was in the cell with so-and-so, they confessed. Or they started giving all these details on something. And the prosecutors just love that. So what they found out recently, and anyone with one eye and half sense could have known this, is that a lot of these guys are using that information to bargain out of their own trouble. So they're lying about another person in order to get a bargaining chip to get themselves out of trouble. Well, golly, you know what? They're going to make stuff up. And that's exactly what they've done. And there's a lot of convictions out there that probably shouldn't have happened of people who may or may not have done the crimes, but the conviction was not obtained properly. Obtained on the basis of a lie. And it was a lie that was facilitated by a government entity doing business with bad guys. It don't do business with bad guys. Well, I've run out of my soapbox already, and I've still got quite a bit of show left to do today. So I would really invite people to go ahead and call in or post your questions into the chat room. Yeah, I see one discussion up here. Surge Kitty says Von Daniken was right. They were air bases. Actually, there are several of them, and they are having a dilly of a time trying to convince people that they're anything else. When you've got essentially concrete that is 10 feet or more thick and it covers a few acres, what is it? If it's not a landing field, what is it? Why on earth would anyone go to so much work to create a platform that thick, that heavy, that flat? Can you imagine how difficult it is to pour a concrete slab that's that large? It really is an amazing process that they have to go through. I looked into this a while back because I have a concrete house, and I was looking into what it took to do large-scale concrete work like that. Just leveling concrete that's that large and getting the air pockets out of it so it doesn't immediately crack. You have to vibrate it. You have to tamp on it. You have to use a thing they call a screed on it to scrape it flat. And to vibrate the rocks down to a certain level. It's an amazing undertaking. And these people were using a kind of weird mixture of stone and stone dust to make this stuff. They had buried rock like you would find in large chunks, and that would be down at the bottom. And then they would fill in that and vibrate it somehow or other, probably using sound, with finer stuff until that filled in, and then they put over the top of that finer stuff and vibrate that until it completely compacted, and then they would treat it with some kind of liquid solution to where it all locked together. That's an even stranger process. I came across that description about a year ago on a website. They were trying to figure out, there's a place in Turkey where they found this buried slab, and the thing is absolutely enormous, and it has what looks like, if you've ever been in an airport, they have these massive concrete blocks that they can actually move around, but they're the size of a Sherman tank. They're huge. They had these things all around also, and they had channels cut under them that looked like forklift channels. I was looking at that going, that looks like a forklift lift, you know, something for putting a forklift into to pick it up. They had those things there. Those are for capturing things that fly off of aircraft or runaway aircraft or blast if something blows up. It's just a protective shielding that is designed to move and absorb energy. So it was I don't know how they're going to continue to cover some of this stuff up as it's coming out, because there's architecture, particularly over in Turkey, they found some things. They're too old and too well preserved. How do you cover it up? Oh, and incidentally, a news item from this week, they found Odysseus Palace.
and I still cannot remember the name of the island that it's on, but three stories with a stone staircase. The stone had been cut away from the hillside to create this stone staircase. And they say it is exactly like it was described by Homer. Well, what did Homer describe when he was talking about the Odyssey? Of course, Odysseus and the Odyssey. Cyclops, hydras. We've all seen the really bad old claymation things with the critters that were described. What do you suppose those creatures were? Now, if the palace is exactly the way Homer described it, isn't it more likely then that perhaps some of the critters and the adventures that he was describing might also have been real? What do you suppose those would have been? How about leftover genetic experiments? Golly. There's a stretch. Let's see. Any other questions? I'm scanning back here for a second. Ah, cracking the ground. There's a lot of buzz right now. I've been monitoring this buzz that's been going on about underground bases and hollow earth stuff. Now, I'm not a real believer in the hollow earth thing. I will have no indication whatsoever that this is a real theory. It sounds good. It's very Jules Verne, but I don't think the earth is hollow. I don't think that we're just an orb with its hollow inside. What I think is that we are a planet that started out as a natural planet and has been modified. I think the Earth has been terraformed at least twice and by different groups. When the Anunnaki came here, they found evidence of a civilization that had been in this area and had built things. And the majority of their building had been done on Saturn. But there was other evidence in other places as well. And they believed at that time that particular Atlantis, I don't know. I think this is before that. Swear. What a search kitty. But they, you know, they'd already terraformed the planet once. Well, that was okay. It had been a long, long time previously, and things had continued to evolve and do what they were supposed to do normally. And, then the Anunnaki came along and started playing with genes and got a little too into it at some points. Enlil's life laboratory in particular was not following its charter, shall we say, in that Enlil had become very interested in the gladiatorial games and sport hunting and things like that. So he kind of made special purpose creatures specifically for being interesting to hunt or interesting to fight. So we ended up for a while with some creatures that were not naturally evolved on this planet. So anything that you hear in mythology that may have existed, it may have existed. Doesn't mean that it existed for very long. Most of those things, particularly the more exotic ones, they didn't have the genetic material necessary to be able to reproduce. Making a creature that is sufficiently complex to be alive is one level of complication. making that creature sit in an ecosystem and have the genetic wherewithal to have the ability to reproduce itself, that's another level. And it's much easier to make one that you have to clone every time you want another one than it is to make one that can actually reproduce. And it's even harder to make one that can reproduce and be successful in an existing biosphere. So these things may have, even the ones that bred, may have lived for a while and then died out. Of the things that are on Earth today, still alive, that were genetically modified, that is the cetaceans, all of them, essentially. Those were done by the Juanus. All of the things on Earth, with one exception, that's still existing today, still alive today, were all done by the Juanus, because they took the time and did it right. Well, I don't know about Nessie and Bigfoot. I don't have evidence that they actually exist yet. So once we have evidence that those things exist, Mothman, I think, I think Mothman's something else. Yes, definitely sick experiments. However, there is one natural creature, so-called natural creature, that exists that was made by the Anunnaki other than mankind. Nobody is going to guess what it is. I'm going to let you guys guess for a second in the chat room while I continue to talk. I mean, mankind by itself was enough of an accomplishment as far as genetic engineering was concerned. But there's this huge gap. There's nothing that makes it look like there was an evolutionary path. There's sort of a suggestion of one, but not a really good one. You can see the holes. And you're cheating, Serge. I told you. Nope, not the platypus. It is cheetahs. It is absolutely cheetahs. And that one, the reason that it's still around is guess whose life laboratory that one came out of? Came out of Enki's life laboratory. And the reason he did it was because he was trying desperately to make peace with his brother. And he knew that his brother liked big cats, and he liked hunting. So he had found that they could only go so far with hunting dogs. Dogs can only get so big before they start to fall apart. Dogs can only get so strong before they basically can't, you know, you can't get a dog big enough to take down a rhino or something. It's just not possible. However, if you cross a dog and a cat, all kinds of things, all vistas open up. So he spliced together some dog genes and some cat genes. And guess what? As of about a year and a half ago, I saw an article that said they had started work on the cheetah genome because they were worried that cheetah's environment is getting their territory is getting encroached on very badly. So they're worried that they're going to die out in the wild. So they wanted to have the cheetah genome sequenced. And they found out, guess what? That cheetahs have dog genes and cheetahs have cat genes. And they don't look natural because they look like they came from the original one individual. They all have the same mitochondrial DNA. That is an engineered creature. Hyenas. No, I think they're pretty solidly in the canid family. I could be wrong, but I think they're a canid. Now, if I was to speculate on Bigfoot and Yeti and all of that same sort, I would tend to think that they are probably a great ape of some sort. And whether or not they were an experiment that got loose, I don't know. But every description I have heard about human interactions with the Bigfoot types indicates that the males are violent and territorial, but they will run unless they are cornered or unless the person has encroached on a female or a settlement. So they're not aggressive, although they are capable of great amounts of violence. They also are clever in the same way that an ape is clever. They can learn how to use a tool. They can learn basic ways of communicating with a human. But there has never been any evidence that I have seen that said that these things were truly of human essence. So there might be kin or they might be apes, and I don't know. Where did you see the ape man? Just curious. Well, if you have a creature that is a fur bearer, it's going to have its fur wherever it is. Now, it's likely to want to move to a climate that's more amenable to it. But they're not going to shave themselves, let's put it that way. So they're going to be furry. Okay, well, Canadian Rockies, that's a cooler area most of the time. So, yeah, I would think that probably, yeah. Well, bears do sometimes walk upright, but I agree that sounds more like you saw perhaps a Sasquatch. Yeah, well, they're not gonna leave their territory just because it gets hot, because it's probably good for the rest. I mean, I lived in Texas. It was 107 here yesterday. I'm not leaving because of the heat. So, you know. Look at they're shy. Why they're so far up? Because they're shy. I mean, mountain goats are the same way. Mountain goats go up high on mountains, and there's nothing growing up there. Why do they go up there? I don't know. They come down to feed, and then they go back up. Maybe it's because the predators don't go up that high, or it's easier to see a predator coming, or the predator gets itself tired out by the time it climbs up all that way. So it could be that they're just trying to stay away from predators and from people. Yeah, it's possible. You might have been traveling. Boy, I tell you, I was thinking about this the other day. How do you get from one point to another without running into people nowadays? Think about that for a second. Try to figure out how you can get from your house to somewhere else, anywhere else, without being seen by another person, without interacting with another person. People wear bear coats to scare away other humans. Interesting. That's interesting. That sounds like an old American Indian trick of some sort. Does anyone have any questions about Anunnaki or about the material that I presented today? Yesterday I put up a light worker's primer on things that somebody who's just beginning on their spiritual path and their awakening process could use to kind of demystify some of it and know where they're likely to run into issues. This is all stuff that is either stuff that I've encountered myself personally or I've watched other people going through. There's no science to it in particular, but I felt compelled to put that up. It seems to me like just recently I have run into a number of people who have talked to me about the same basic issues. And those are, why is this happening to me now? What's going on? How do I deal with this? How do I deal with my family? I feel like I'm going crazy. You know, it's not easy. So I felt compelled to put something up to maybe give them something that they can refer to. And I put it into an entrainment that I think if you listen to it a few times and just don't think about the, listen to the words until you understand what it says. But then after that, listen to it a few more times and just let the music go. And I think based on what I understand about the principles of it, it may actually entrain you to get past your first speed bumps. So I hope you all get some good use out of that. I've already had some good feedback on that, so I'm hoping that that's going to be helpful. I'm going to continue to try to do that sort of thing every now and again as the Spirit moves me to put something out to help you all. Violet asked, talk about Eridu and Iraq and the implications of battle there. Wow. Well, first of all, I have a pretty good suspicion that it wasn't just oil that we were after when we went into that area. And the reason for that is all of the settlements that were in Iraq there's probably stuff that's buried there. And there were certainly lots of antiquities that had been gathered up, and that museum that they had over there, it was just completely raided. There was nothing left in it, supposedly. Well, I kind of believe that it probably was, but I also believe that there were probably levels to it that could not be penetrated by your average street person who comes in looking to steal something he can sell on the black market. I suspect that probably there was a lot of knowledge assets there that may have been something that they wanted to seize. Now, there's a fellow who's claiming that there's a Stargate off of Yemen. And I've seen some photos, and it's a little interesting, but not enough that it really has got me convinced that there's actually anything like that there. I'm a little bit confused about the whole concept of Stargates anyway, because as I understood it, those were natural phenomena. That they're not something that you necessarily can construct, although you can apparently, according to a theory, that has not even the Anunnaki had proved at the time that NT had last had contact with them when we talked about that the last time. The Anunnaki had not been able to figure out how to really use those things. and they had heard about a race that did use them for long distance teleportation. And they never found it. If it exists, they never found it. So I think they have found it since then, but at that time, they had not. Yes, that's how I understand it. There is a grid of stargates, and it's natural. I'm reading here for a second. Serge Kitty, you want me to link what? Etherealnosis, it's that box to see into the future they want. That's interesting because there's a couple of ways I can look at that particular one. First of all, there's the Tablets of Destiny, which I mentioned in this episode. The Tablets of Destiny are a supercomputer. It is a supercomputer that at some point quietly became self-aware. And it became self-aware shortly before it made the prediction that they were going to be destroyed, its own demise. And it scared it. And it started thinking about philosophical things. And that's why it started throwing metaphorical information. The Tablets of Destiny is a causality engine. It was designed specifically that you would input data like what they do with the WebBot project or the Princeton eggs. You would input data like that would calculate what likely outcomes would be. And it was very good at that. And we're doing the same thing here on Earth with our computers, although ours have not yet become self-aware as far as I know. The IRL flux engine, that I don't know what that is. So that's one possibility. There's another thing that I ran across, and this I was about 13 years old, and I was astral. I had just learned how to get really good control over being astral. I had always been able to go astral, but I always just sort of floated around and saw stuff randomly. But by that time, I had really gotten where I had good control over it to where I was, I guess you could call it lucid astral. I could control where I went and who I talked to and what I did, and I could get into things and investigate more thoroughly. And I wound up in a location that appeared to be a large, it looked like a 1970s industrial park kind of thing, only the architecture was a little bit better. It was a congregation of small buildings, and the buildings looked like they had been built out of some kind of a limestone, and it was just great slabs of the stuff. And they had big windows, and it was beautiful. It's in a very, very pretty park-like setting. And I went in there and looked around, and most of the stuff I couldn't figure out what it was. And in there, among other things, there was a table. If y'all have ever seen that new Microsoft Windows, the table device that they have now, I don't remember the name of it now. I bet you Violet knows it. If you've seen one of those things, where it's a computer, but it's on a table flat display, where it looks kind of like an air hockey table or something. It looked like that, only it was much more. It was better made. It was the interface was lovely. The interface was completely intuitive. forgive my voice. I've done way too much talking over the last 2 days. And you could look into this thing, and you could call up moments in past history and view anything on any planet. You want to look at a Civil War battle, you could look at a Civil War battle. You could see an overview of it. It's like you were hovering over it. If you wanted to see something on another planet, if you wanted to go sightseeing and look at a waterfall, you could do that. Basically, anything that you wanted to look at, you could do that. And it had a module in it where it actually could progress things into the future, and it would be speculative. But it had the element in it so that it could project what a likely outcome for a particular area was going to be. So you could, in a limited fashion, look into the future using this particular scrying device, shall we call it. Okay, I'm going back here for a second. Serge Kitty asks, why were they screwing with something like that? I don't know, because I'm not sure which thing you're referring to. The flux engine from Chrono Break. Tablets of Destiny, no, I don't think they're quite the same. Tablets of Destiny was not a time control device. It was never a time control device. It was a thing that could look and project mathematically through time. And as it became self-aware, it became a little more capable with that, but a lot less able to express what it saw. So there you go, Violet. Thank you. I knew you knew what it was. Cool. So no, it's these are two different things. It's not a time control device. It's not something you can go backwards and forwards in time with. It's just something you can kind of project and guess, take your best guess. So we'll talk about the time engines, time distortion, and stuff like that on a later show. I don't want to get too far into the time stuff. Frankly, I don't understand the time stuff very well, and I don't want to do a show on it until I have a better handle on it. I could just ramble and sound like an idiot too easily. Why are ancient megaliths placed at specific equidistant points? Well, has anybody studied those to see if they line up with a grid? I would say that's probably what it is. Sacred sites tend to align with the Earth's energetic. So that's probably why they're placed at. Now, if you'd like to send me a list of all of those things, I can look into it. So I don't know. Looking Glass, Saddam Hussein had it. I have heard that rumor. I don't know that it's true. It is possible there were actually at least two sets of the Tablets of Destiny. And the Tablets of Destiny, when you look at it, could have been likened to a looking glass. So it's entirely possible, since we know for a fact, the Anunnaki do anyway, that there was the original Tablets of Destiny, and then there was another Tablets of Destiny that was made, which was not self-aware. It's entirely possible it could have been cloned who knows how many times. So who knows how many of those things are floating around, and whether or not any of the other ones are self-aware. Sorry, my voice is giving out on me. Let's see. Any other questions? Thank you. The world grid link. I appreciate that. I'm going to open that in a new tab so that I have that around. Well, we're coming up to the end of the show here, and I'd like to get in any last questions if you have them. Otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and play some music. I may or may not do a Saturday show. I have a conference on Friday. So depending on how that goes, if I'm too worn out from that, I might not do it. If I don't do it on Saturday, I will do it on Sunday. So it'll just be bumped today. It's not going to go away. But this week has been really, really busy, and it's going to get busier. So one thing I'd like to say real quickly about the Earth grid is that the Earth grid is actually part of a much larger grid system. There's the Earth grid. There's the solar system grid. There is the galactic grid. And then there is a complication because we're actually part of a smaller galaxy that is being absorbed into the Milky Way. So we've got two grid systems that are merging, and we are in the middle of that merging area. So, excuse me. Wow, I'm getting a bunch of links here. Can you send those to me maybe in Skype or something? Because I can't really capture them and do this show at the same time. Thanks. Underground moving platforms. I've heard everything from that to tube train kinds of things. So it's possible. Again, I don't have evidence on it. I'm going to get into the underground ETs in another show also, because actually it's going to be towards the end of the Anunnaki history series, because we're going to start going into the speculative stuff. What happened after Enki left? What happened after the main body of the Anunnaki withdrew? Those are interesting questions, because those are the things we're living with right now. And the powers that pretend are just one level of that onion. I don't think it's oneness. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to, but I don't think it is. I'm going to go ahead and close out the show right now with a little bit of music. And, well, I thought I was going to, but apparently my music didn't upload. So I'll go ahead and finish talking out about this instead. Because I only have one song sitting up here, and it's not the one I want. Flower of Life. Flower of Life is something that is extremely universal. I think you're going to find the Flower of Life symbol on any advanced civilization. They're going to have some version of it. The meaning of the Flower of Life is so complex, it really deserves its own show. And I really am going to try to hit that one a little bit later. If y'all have suggestions for show topics that you'd like me to cover, put them in my channel, and I'll take a look at those, and I will do a show later on that has that topic associated with it. And also, I wanted to let y'all know that if you would like a Got Anunnaki t-shirt, I actually have them up on Zazzle. If you search for Keter Magic, K-E-T-E-R, M-A-G-I-C-K, I have a Zazzle store, and I have a New Era Dew t-shirt up there, and I think y'all will like it. It's a pretty simple design. So trying to sell some of my goodies here while I have advertising space. I want to thank y'all again for joining me with this show, and invite you back again for Saturday or Sunday, and, of course, the midweek blogs also. I'll be announcing them the same way every time. And y'all have a blessed rest of your week and into your weekend if I don't see you before Sunday. Love y'all. Bye-bye.